Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
Anytime you can do something that's fun, you like to do it and make money doing it, hey, it's a win-win-win. And anytime you can win-win-win, you're win-win-winning, you know? If you're just winning or win-winning, that's just winning or win-winning. But when you're win-win-winning, you're win-win-winning.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
All right. Hey, Jason, thanks for coming on the podcast. You are the longest tenured Quiet Light brokerage advisor. So nice to have you on. I was actually just talking to Zachary, who was one of the deals that you've completed in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Really good guy, and had a lot of praise to shovel on you for the work that you did selling his business. Yeah, we got a lot of stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that the word is tenured because I just hit my 10 years with Quiet Light Brokerage.
10 years, really?
Wow. Yeah, well, it was March of 2010, so I don't remember the date, but it took about 3 months to get you to return my call.
That's pretty funny. And we're recording this, by the way, right in the heart of major economic disasters and everything else. And when you came on initially, it was just as we were coming out of the Great Recession. And I remember, you know, when you and I first talked, my attitude, because, you know, we kind of got crushed during that. My attitude was, I'm just going to make as much money as I can this year on my own, right? I had no plans on bringing anybody on, but man, am I glad that I did, because obviously you paved the road for what we have today.
Well, and I appreciate the opportunity. I mean, the thing I remember thinking at the time, we were in the heart of the great financial crisis. Nobody was hiring. I was an entrepreneur, but I needed income. I live in Nevada, and we got hit hard with the housing downturn. My house dropped in half. My stocks dropped in half. And it was sort of this epiphany that with these web businesses, you can work from home. You can create your own income. As a broker, it could be the same thing. As you can see, I'm sitting at home right now. And it just struck me as a win-win. And one really interesting thing, when I came on in 2010, even though we're in the heart of the crisis, there were plenty of buyers. There was no shortage of people buying web businesses. And obviously some did really well, some didn't, but you know, not to try to manifest Warren Buffett or anything, but you know, sometimes the opportunities are when things are down.
Yeah, I think we personally call you the Oracle of Reno, so you can channel Warren Buffett all you like. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, we came onto this thinking that we were going to talk about the what to do in a competitive situation. Maybe we'll get to that, but why don't we, you know what, Chris, our CMO, has been asking me to do something topical. You and I love to talk about the economy and stuff. Do you mind if we just kind of pivot a little bit and talk about the opportunity, actually? Because what was it like to go through that Great Recession? I started Quiet Light Brokerage before the Great Recession.
Okay, maybe I could tell a little more of my personal story.
Yeah, please.
Instructive. So for anyone who I don't know personally who might be watching this, I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I had the entrepreneurial itch. And I started a company right at the peak of the dot-com bubble. And when I say peak, I mean I raised $10 million about 6 weeks before the bubble popped for a company I'd started. That company went down the tubes. I pretty quickly learned cash flow is important. It's not all about storytelling. You need real cash flow. So my next business, I had a couple small ones in there, but my next good one, I was generating leads for realtors from 2003 to 2007. That one did amazing, but we all know what happened around 2007, 2008. So that business crumbled, unfortunately. So then I bought a website, and it was not through Quiet Light Brokerage. I remember at the time talking to all the brokers and thinking, boy, that Mark Douse guy seems really more honest and ethical, but hey, I can get a deal from someone else. What I discovered was the quote deal that I thought I was getting was really just a lack of disclosure. There were a lot of things wrong with the business that Quiet Light would have told me about, but the other brokerage didn't. And that left a really bad taste in my mouth. So then I sought out Mark with Quiet Light and said, will you please sell my business? Mark sold it for me. And that's when I realized the difference with this brokerage, because Mark brought a bunch, Mark said to me, Jason, you have to reveal all the bad stuff, not just the good stuff. And I said, wait, what? That's going to scare off buyers. And Mark said, this is the way we do things, take it or leave it. I said, okay, I'll take it. Sure enough, Mark brought me multiple offers in the middle of, or like really close to the bottom of that last bad recession. And I realized, wow, the way to do things is full disclosure, full honesty, never pressure any buyer, never pressure any seller. Let adults make adult decisions based on all the information available. So then I asked Mark if I could come aboard, and it's kind of grown since then. And you know, I don't have a crystal ball about the future, but I still have the same beliefs I had 10 years ago, which is every deal should be fully transparent. No one should ever feel pressure. And you know, different people have different levels of risk aversion versus risk-taking mentality. And one of the important things is to recognize realistically and honestly where you fall on the risk-taking spectrum. That's almost more important than what business you're buying.
Yeah, and let's actually rewind the clock to the business that you sold, and we won't get into the details of the business, but I remember your financials. I remember that they looked like every other company I dealt with at the time, which had declining numbers.
Yeah.
Right. We were in the middle of a major contraction across the entire economic spectrum. And so for a few years, it was kind of par for the course for a lot of buyers to look at businesses that had declining financials. And as you know, most of the people that listen to this podcast are in some sense related to being a buyer. Maybe they want to be, or they're working their way up, or they are an existing buyer, or they're just interested in that. You know, getting accustomed to seeing businesses that don't always have graphs up and to the right can be a little unnerving when that's what we've been seeing for the past 10 years. But yeah, like you said, when I worked with you to sell that business, there were multiple buyers for it because those were great buying opportunities.
Yeah. So the important thing I think is for anyone whose goal is to do a quick flip, buy a business, add value, sell it next year, this is not the market for you. I think the opportunity has passed. I think the buyers who are going to do well in this next market segment are the ones who take a longer term view and can say, I'm looking at this business. I think it's sustainable because A, B, and C. I can see that it's down right now, but over 10 years, I think it'll produce X amount of cash flow, and I can buy it today for, I don't know, 1/10 of X or whatever's the price. And importantly, I've got the temperament to stick with it because there can be some lean months. And most important, if I'm taking out debt on this, my debt service is low enough that even if things go really bad, I'm not going to have to liquidate. I'll be able to make my debt service. I'll be able to pay my mortgage on my house. I'll be able to keep my spouse happy. So really, rather than looking at deals with absolutely optimistic, you know, projections in your eyes, I think it's important to think through, what if a worst case scenario happens? Will I still be happy 5 years from now having made this decision?
Yeah, and I think you touched on this a little bit, and that was when you're looking at the downturn, the exercise that you need to go through, and it's really individual to each business, is why is there a downturn? And sometimes there is something significantly wrong with the business that you have to address, right? There, that time, with the Great Recession, there were really two things that were kind of coalescing together. One was obviously the economy was contracting, but Google was also changing rapidly how sites were being ranked. And so we saw a lot of businesses that were dependent on that natural search traffic. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you bring that up. So this would almost pivot to suggestions for sellers. And the biggest suggestion is don't be greedy. So I remember in 2011, you gave me a lead for someone that you knew, and he wanted me to give him a valuation for his series of websites that were all ranked on organic traffic. And he said, what do you think it's worth? I said, I think it's worth about $1 million. He said, no, I would never sell for that. See you later. He called me about 2 months later and said, what do you think it's worth? I said, I think it's worth maybe 50 to 100 grand. You can guess what happened in between. Google did some serious algorithm updates and that wiped out his value. Now, certainly I would not have felt good selling it to a buyer for $1 million and having it crash. But again, I do believe adults can make adult decisions as long as everything is disclosed. So I think it's important for buyers to think through what could happen. And it's important for sellers to also think through, you know, am I holding out simply because I've got a number in my head, or I'm trying to impress my friends in the entrepreneur club or something like that? Or am I being practical and saying, if I sell today, I've got my nut, I've got my nugget, and I'm set for the next 10 years. I think the latter is the smarter way to consider things, rather than anything that involves ego usually does not lead to the best result.
Yeah. And obviously it's easy to talk like this in retrospect, right? Had he known what was going to happen, he would have gladly taken even, you know, 900 or 750,000 for those sites. But you know, I heard something recently in a book I'm listening to on Audible, talking about investing and encouraging people to say, you know what, being an average investor is good, because that means you're beating a lot of other people that are trying to beat the average and end up losing big time. And we see that a lot as well. Selling your business for an average amount might not sound very attractive. And obviously, look, I want to sell a business for as much as we can to service our clients. Yeah. But you're right, there's a realistic level in there. And sometimes, you know, the hottest home run hitters in baseball strike out the most. And the same holds true in this industry.
And that's kind of where the risk tolerance comes in. I mean, some sellers want to swing for the fences, and they may get their price, and you know, they may strike out. But I think for the vast majority of people, you know, clearly we've got some buyers and some sellers that are very sophisticated. We've got some sellers that are running, you know, multi-8-figure, maybe even 9-figure, you know, kind of sales numbers, and definitely a lot of 7-figure sales numbers. We've got some buyers that have raised a lot of money. But for the vast majority of people, they're what I classify as mom and pop entrepreneurs, meaning they've got good experience, they're smart people, but they're not backed by enormous amounts of capital. And in those cases, I think it's more important to think about, how does the decision to buy or sell affect my personal life, my real life, my ability to afford my house, my lifestyle, my kids, my vacation plans, stuff like that, I think becomes more important than trying to max out the absolute value on either as a buyer or a seller.
Yeah. So let me ask you this on the buy side again, because there's two things I want to really focus on when we see a pullback in the economy, and it all relates to multiples that you end up seeing on businesses. The natural inclination, I think, especially if we do head into a recession right now and we see this trickle-down effect, well, over the next few months, if I could peer into a crystal ball, and look, this is going to be recorded, so I guess everyone that's listening a year from now, tell me how wrong I was, because there's going to be elements here that are wrong. But trickle-down effect here. We've had supply chain issues in China. That's going to have at least a temporary blip on people's P&Ls that we're not able to get those products. The question right now, as we sit and record this, is consumer confidence, and will people spend the same way that they've been spending before? But the chances of that seem to be kind of remote, that they will be doing that. So what's going to happen? We're going to see some P&Ls declining in a very likely scenario here. And the natural result is that the multiples go down. At what point from a buyer's perspective, and I'm putting you a bit on the spot here, but at what point from a buyer's perspective should we start to expect some downward pressure on some of the multiples that we're seeing on current listings?
Sure. Okay, it's a great question. So what I recall, keep in mind, I started 10 years ago in March 2010. So I was not at Quiet Light during the down part of the downturn, but I did sell my business through you in 2009, which was pretty bad. The multiple you got for me was probably a little bit above 2x, if memory serves. However, my business was undesirable in that I had only owned it for like 6 months. So my record keeping wasn't that good. I think had I been someone who owned that same business for 3 years and had clean records, I think even then it would have gone for 2.5x. Now, so in the 10 years I've been here, the multiples have expanded, but not ridiculously so. I mean, our average e-commerce business still sells for what, 3?
A little over three over the past 12 months, like 3.2 on average. And that covers a pretty wide strata of businesses.
Okay. So the bigger change then is what the multiple is being applied to, which is what, you know, around here, we call it seller's discretionary earnings. For anyone who doesn't know that term, it's basically what could an owner keep for him or herself if, you know, you aren't buying that trip to Hawaii and calling it a business trip, you know, stuff like that. Like what's the real bottom line? Now, if that goes down, even if multiples stay the same, the prices go down, right? And that's the bigger variable. In your own calculations, you say, what do I think this business is going to do over the next 10 years? I understand I'm a broker. When buyers talk to me, they're going to lay out the most negative case. That's your job. I get it. Sellers are going to lay out the most optimistic case, but ultimately there is a market. I feel very confident that I could take almost any internet business and sell it in one day because there is a price at which everything will sell. And as you know, over the years, I've sold a few that were, you know, should have been quote unsellable because tell me if you remember this one. This was my first year. We had an e-commerce business that sold a particular type of product, a children's product. They had shut down the website 8 months before we ever met them. And so it had literally zero revenue. They owed a ton of money to suppliers. I don't want to say the name. I don't want to break any confidentiality. We got five offers that all included at least $100,000 cash up front and then some form of earnout. So the point is, there's always a market. There's always going to be buyers. There's always going to be competition. So to both buyers and sellers, my suggestion is don't get greedy. Be sensible. Try to get the deal that makes sense for the long term, but don't be greedy or you're more likely to lose out to, you know, if you're a seller, you just won't sell. And if you're a buyer, you'll lose out to another buyer.
Yeah, I remember that deal. I actually referenced that deal a decent amount. And you might remember most about that is that this is back when we held escrow funds for the deals, which was a bad idea. But I had to go into the bank in person in the bank and process like 10 or 12 wires to all the vendors. It was such a pain. It took like 2 hours.
And this is actually a good time for me to plug Quiet Light and why I think it's a step above some of the others. So with the e-commerce business that I had bought from a different brokerage that you sold for me, one of the big discoveries after the fact was that the seller didn't pay the vendors. And then the vendors started calling me and saying, hey, how can I find the seller? The vendors wouldn't extend me terms. It was a lot of messy stuff. So on the one that we're talking about now that I sold through Quiet Light, we got all that stuff figured out up front. You know, we said, what do you owe to whom? I personally called all the vendors and said, if I can get you paid off with the sale, will you work with the new owner? Those are little things that a buyer may not think about, but that makes all the difference in, you know, whether your purchase is enjoyable and a potentially good investment, or if it's headache after headache, which when I purchased my e-com business from another brokerage, it was headache after headache.
Yeah, no, I ran into that with my e-com purchase as well. The previous owner didn't pay some vendors, and of course, who do they look to? And that's a great way to start off your first 3 to 6 months of owning a business, right? Running into vendor issues and having them resent you for something you never did, right? You might be a great payer, but they still resent you. Going back to the Great Recession when we went through that, you know, one phenomenon, I've talked about this a little bit. I talked about it at the time as well. One phenomenon that I saw that really annoyed me with buyers is they seem to get locked into these lower rates. And you've alluded to this in what you're talking about with multiples and when should we expect them to go down? Well, multiples start to go down when you're seeing P&Ls go down, right? And you're seeing the income go down. And just naturally, the multiple is going to be lower there. But then what happened on the reverse when things started to grow again is buyers got accustomed to these relatively low multiples. I think, you know, at the time I was quoting top prices of 2.75 or 2.8 on e-commerce businesses. And then I got some really good, fast growing businesses. And buyers were like, whoa, why are you asking 3.2 for this? I'm like, well, because it's growing. We haven't seen this in forever. It's like a long lost cousin. Well, and people wouldn't do it. Sellers, conversely, hearing this, and rightfully so, were hearing these prices for their growing businesses saying, why would I ever sell for that? I would never sell for 2.7. I'm growing. So I guess as we go through this, if you were to be talking to a buyer and trying to advise them through this, you know, there's definitely opportunity, right? As we go down.
Yeah. And the challenging thing on any individual deal that I'm repping, I'm not going to give too much suggestion to the buyer. I'm not going to say this thing is going to continue to grow or anything like that, because it might not. And I don't want the emotional responsibility if I gave someone too optimistic a view. But on a grander scheme, I don't think you have to nail the top or the bottom of a market. I mean, let's look at the stock market as a corollary. You didn't need to buy on March 9th, 2009 and sell on February, whatever it was, 3 weeks ago, which might have been the peak of the bull market. You could have bought any time in 2010, 2011, sold any time in 2017 or 2018, and still done really well. It's the same with websites. Don't try to nail the bottom. Don't try to nail the top. And again, like hammering someone on a multiple on a very fast growing business is a form of being greedy. You're trying to get tomorrow's earnings for yesterday's price, which you need, to make a market, you need a willing buyer and a willing seller. Put yourself in the seller's shoes. They're thinking, I'm growing at such a rate that what you just offered me, I'm going to earn that in a year and a half anyway. Yeah, they're right. Why should they sell?
Yeah. So let's talk about industries and what is survivable. And again, we're both playing gypsy here, reading into crystal balls to say what's going to survive. But with your experiences, we're going into a potentially more difficult time. And again, this all assumes that this happens. I'll be deleting this episode if we end up going back into a bull market for the next year.
It'll be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, what would be sustainable in your opinion for sort of the long term as a good buy opportunity?
So it'll be interesting to see if COVID-19, the coronavirus, permanently changes people's behavior. For instance, are companies less likely to send their employees on airplanes and more likely to do Zoom conferences? Are people less likely to seek entertainment at concerts and more likely to watch Netflix? That kind of thing. So one interesting aspect is everything we sell is an online business. I think, you know, if I had to spitball, I would say online is probably, I'm probably more bullish about online businesses than real world businesses. I'd be probably more inclined to buy a business that operates on the internet that people can do from home than to buy a bounce house, you know, real world location where kids are spreading germs. Now that said, I think there's potentially much bigger economic things that can overwhelm all of this. If we run into a credit crunch, that kind of supersedes everything. So, you know, you think back to the great financial crisis, it was the credit crunch that crashed all asset classes, regardless of how good the thesis was. So when I say I like online over real world, that's a relative position, but, you know, be wary. The Federal Reserve, the president, the Congress, they've got a whole lot more power to influence this stuff than any of us do. And none of us control what they do.
Yeah, the credit crunch is an interesting point to bring up. I mean, that definitely was the problem back in the Great Recession. And I remember, you know, when I started Quiet Light Brokerage, we were selling $50,000 to $100,000 sites for the most part. So people weren't using credit anyways. Yeah. And then as we kind of grew through the recession, we were growing in average deal size, you know, doing some seven-figure transactions and high nine-figure transactions. And they were cash buyers or buyers that were using other securities to get a loan and pledge those securities against against the loan that they were getting. They were being creative with their financing. SBA was non-existent. And I remember it took me like a year or 2 years to convince you to that SBA was actually lending again.
Well, do you remember why? Because my first year, somebody made an offer contingent on SBA and I took him at his word and I knew nothing about it. 6 months later, you know, after delay, I said, what's going on? And he said, oh, I'm on my fourth lender, but they tell me it's going to happen. And then back then, like you said, we were holding earnest deposits. That was the only time in 10 years that we didn't return a complete earnest deposit to a buyer because he agreed to it. He acknowledged that he had wasted a lot of people's time. So yeah, you're right. I was the holdout on believing that the SBA would write loans and they might stop again. And my thought is if that happens, we're probably the higher end of our market, which today, I mean, would you agree that maybe 20 or 30 million is the high end of our market?
Yeah, right.
That's outside the SBA range. But we've also done a lot of deals that are 2 million to 5 million, which is within the SBA range. There might be many fewer of those deals, but I think on the lower end, you know, 500,000 to a million, I think those will continue relatively unabated.
Yeah, and I'm pretty skeptical of the idea that we would have as much of a drawback as we did during the Great Recession on SBA loans. The SBA loans during the recession immediately were no loans on Goodwill, which is essentially an online business, all Goodwill. And then it was raised to 200 or 250,000 was the max loan that you could get on Goodwill. And then that raised slowly to 500,000. And now we're at, again, the max limits for SBA loans altogether, which is the 5 million. And it took a while to get there. But yeah. That was the real problem is that, you know, you might be able to get an SBA loan, but it didn't make sense to do it. Like you said, for a $20 million deal, obviously a different type of buyer, they're not looking SBA anyways, because it's not going to be favorable to their setup. But for those buyers in that 1 to 5 million, I wouldn't expect it to go away. But I would expect some maybe constriction as to the guidelines that they have for those loans.
As you mentioned, we're both looking into our crystal ball. So it's basically guesswork at this point, and it's going to be fun to look back in a year and see who's more accurate. I certainly hope that you're right and I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, if I'm completely wrong, I have power over the podcast and I can delete the episode. So, you know, I reserve that right. Cool. We've been talking for like 20, 25 minutes here on this. And, you know, obviously it's not the most exciting topic to talk about with a recession, but again, opportunistic investors see this, and while we never would rejoice at people losing money and the downstream consequences of a pullback in the economy, you know, people lose their jobs and it does have a real world effect. We should sense some opportunity here and also an opportunity to build on a more stable foundation in the future. And I would encourage the buyers that are out there that have a risk tolerance, like you said, Jason, for this sort of an asset, to see this for what it is, not get too wrapped up in the multiples that come in. There should be some good opportunistic buys if all this does unwind, and so many ifs and, you know, yeah, what ifs and all that. Any last thoughts for potential buyers that are eyeing this asset class?
Yeah. Well, one of my friends always quotes, he says predictions are hard, especially about the future.
They're great about the past.
Yeah. Right now today we're sitting here as the corona, you know, virus is starting to have an outbreak in America and in Europe. You know, we're hearing scary headline after scary headline. It is possible that all of this passes in 6 months and, you know, the summer comes, it heats up, it kills the virus, and it may end up being like a Y2K where it was a whole lot of panic for nothing. So I would encourage everyone, don't get too set in whatever your beliefs are. Just monitor what's actually happening and try to keep your head and make rational decisions. And yes, if there's a downturn, there's opportunities. And if there's not a downturn, I always go back to at 3x, you make your money back in 3 years. That strikes me as a pretty good deal as long as you can keep the website going.
Absolutely. Jason, you're a font of wisdom. You are the Oracle of Reno and of Quiet Light Brokerage. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light content team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast Or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.